commercial and government online identity theft forces the White House to give agencies a lead role in better protecting web transactions. President Obama announces major changes to the security of government credit cards and other methods of payment. In the latest edition of Inside the Reporter's Notebook, Federal News Radio executive editor Jason Miller writes about those changes. He's here to talk about what you can expect starting in January. What changes does the president want in government charge cards, Jason?
The biggest change is all about the idea of PIN and password to the credit card. And the idea of PIN and password is above and beyond what you do now, which maybe requires you to just give them your credit card and they look to see if it's been signed. Or if they look at your, they ask you to enter your zip code. This is a whole new technology. So what this does is puts a chip in the card that makes the magnetic stripe on back, the data in that, much harder to steal. And on top of it, it requires you to use a password to enter into the computer. It could be a numerical, it could be a letter password. But that dual factor, that multi-factor authentication is really a what many people believe in the industry is going to really stop or reduce the amount of identity theft that's been happening. I mean, look what we've seen in the last couple months. Mm-hmm. Target, Home Depot, JP Morgan Chase, they are getting hacked because the credit cards, and not that's not the only reason, but the credit card piece is so easy to get into. The hackers, the bad guys are just taking advantage of it. So what the White House is doing is basically saying the agencies are going to lead the way by implementing this new chip and PIN idea of security. And by doing that, that's going to force potentially the rest of society to change. And I think that's the key piece here.
Who will have to do what here, Jason?
So Treasury and GSA really are leading the way. The General Services Administration runs the Smart Pay program, which is the government credit card program. So starting in January, they're going to start implementing, you know, when you get a new card that expires, it will have this chip and PIN technology already built in. So that's the first thing. That's most immediate. Treasury, in the meantime, will change the way they do debit cards and other types of government payments. So if you get Social Security, if you get something that's on a card, not, you know, your direct deposit, but something that's on a card, those cards also will have to have chip and PIN starting in January. The other piece of this that's really interesting is above and beyond just the credit card piece. It's any online transactions will have to start including more secure online technology. So again, if you have a federal website where you're putting in, you know, the IRS, for example, they may already do this to a certain extent, but anything where you're giving them sensitive data or they're giving you back sensitive data based on what you know, mm-hmm. is going to start requiring that two-factor authentication. And this is more of a longer-term idea, but by January, Treasury, GSA, OMB, some others have to come up with a plan. And then 18 months from when this executive order was signed Friday, so not since the plan, but yes. Since the executive order was signed, they have to implement that plan.
How will this make a difference as far as how the agencies do business once this is all in place? Do we have a sense of that yet?
We don't yet, but we know that by requiring chip and PIN technology, it's one going to make things more secure. That has been shown. In fact, there was a study done in the United Kingdom that showed by just implementing this simple technology, they reduced the number of identity theft or attacks by something like 70%.
Wow.
That's how much better it's gotten. And in fact, you know, I spoke with a couple security experts, and John Pescatore, one of them, is a director of emerging security trends at the SANS Institute. And he said, yes, this is a good thing, but this is also something the government should have been doing years ago. Mm-hmm. He pointed out 15 years ago, Presidential Directive Decision 63.
Wow.
I know. I'm surprised. I wonder if he had to look it up or if he knew it by heart.
Well, but basically, PDD 63.
It basically said that the government should serve as a model to the private sector on how infrastructure assurance is best achieved and shall be, to the extent feasible, distribute the results of its endeavors. So basically, yeah. What it's saying is government should lead the way.
Mm-hmm.
What John Pescatore is saying, yes, this is good, but they can do more because this is only looking at the point of sale and you're not looking at other factors, the back end. And he, in fact, is saying even the smart card technology that's being used in government today, HSPD-12, the PIV, is old, it's obsolete, they should move to it. And he goes, something as simple as a text message that gets sent to your phone as a second factor is much more secure than what they're doing today. And he said Google, PayPal, Microsoft, and many others are already using that concept.
Federal News Radio executive editor Jason Miller's here going inside the reporter's notebook. And another item in the notebook this week, Jason, is a big pushback from the Office of Management and Budget about a very critical Inspector General Council, the SIGI Council, on cloud computing across government. The findings were not very positive. positive for the agencies, especially for OMB, who's been pushing a cloud-first policy for a long time now. Why is OMB pushing back on this, and is this unusual for them to do this?
Right. This is something we talked about on your show last week, this big IG report from 19 federal civilian agencies looking at 77 cloud contracts, and they basically found three things. Number one, FedRAMP is not being complied with by agencies. That's the cybersecurity standards for cloud computing contracts and services. Number two, agencies are not doing an inventory of their cloud, of the systems that touch the cloud. So therefore, security also is not there's a lot of risks in that. And third is the contract language and clauses that they're using do not necessarily protect the agency. Well, OMB said, okay, well, we appreciate what the IGs have found, but they also are missing some basic facts and things that we are doing. And one of them is FedRAMP is having a success here. And in fact, OMB points out that there's more than 160 cloud service providers who have FedRAMP authorization, whether it's through the Joint Authorization Board or whether it's through each agency can do their own FedRAMP authorization. But at the same time, OMB recognizes that compliance is still a very important thing, and they point out that they are going to handle compliance in two ways. Number one, agencies will give OMB quarterly reports through the integrated data collection tool, and that will deal with FedRAMP and through Portfolio Stat. And then the second thing is, and this is also interesting, is OMB will build upon this existing reporting mechanism to include clarification of the actual name of systems and contract start dates to monitor whether new contracts are occurring without meeting FedRAMP certification requirements. So they're going to say, when did this contract begin? And if it began after June 5th of this year, then is it cloud compliant? And if it's not, or if it's not on the way to being FedRAMP compliant, then there's a bigger problem.
Mm-hmm. The pushback that we're seeing from OMB, is that unusual? Is that new?
You know, it depends depends what the audit says. Many times you'll see GAO or IG reports that says the agency will respond, ask for technical clarifications, and many times they agree with the recommendations. In this IG compendium report, they had no comments and they had no response from OMB or anyone else. So I thought that was very interesting. So for OMB to come out a little more aggressively and say, we appreciate it, but that is not unusual when you see it in a report. But what's unusual is they do it after the report's been out. Mm-hmm. I think that's key to say that this may have ruffled some feathers over at OMB a little bit.
One more item here. The Air Force is taking a new look at how it manages and uses its applications. And I'm a creature of habit. Whenever I see apps, I think of apps like on a smartphone, but it's a much broader category than that now. And you titled this item, A New Mantra for Air Force Apps. Tell me about that.
Well, the idea here is they have 5,000 apps.
Jeez.
And that's just too many.
Seems
Let's start
like
there.
A lot.
And remember, the Air Force is a big place.
So sure, but
5,000.
Yeah, 5,000, man. That's
So Frank Konietzky, who is the Air Force Chief Technology Officer, he was on a panel that Federal News Radio will be airing later this month. And basically, he said, we have too many apps. We have to reduce them. So we came up with this new approach with four, if you will, business line managers. And each business line manager, their job is to rationalize the apps, cut it, consolidate it, or modernize it. And if they modernize it, it's got to be on one of four platforms as a service, so in the cloud. So three Java platforms and one .NET platform. And that's the technology that's kind of the underlying technology behind it. And basically what Frank Konietzky said is, We have to. It's costing us too much. It's too much shadow IT. It's not. We can't mitigate the risks, and we don't know what cyber risks we're facing. So if we can get control and make sure we're meeting the mission needs, but also doing it at a less cost and have better standards and better cyber, that's going to be better for everybody. So it was just a fascinating discussion we had, and the fact is, he said that these new mission managers, these business line managers, were just named in October, and they're just starting down this path of reducing and rationalizing this huge 5,000, a catalog of software titles.
You used the term shadow IT a moment ago, and I know you've used that before, and we've talked about it on the program, but just refresh my memory what that means.
That's the idea where IT is being invested or implemented without the CIO knowing or without the CIO having any control. So they may know about it, but they can't stop it. And that puts agencies at risk, because if you're implementing a specific technology that doesn't meet your architecture or doesn't meet cybersecurity standards, then the CIO can't protect it. And then that could be potentially a backdoor, or it could just mean there's a lack of interoperability between two key systems, because Office X didn't know that Office Y was investing in this technology, and they invested in something that's totally the opposite,
yeah.
and the two don't talk, and create the middleware would be an added expense. So there's a lot more risk in the idea of shadow with the idea of shadow IT.
What I think is instructive about this is that Frank Konechny says that they've already kind of started this process. You have a quote here: "I know based on our experience at Hill Air Force Base, where we already rationalized 400 or 500 apps there, the way to do this was to standardize on a set of platforms." And then he said licensing and maintenance are easier. So this is something that they kind of already have. It's almost like it sounds like they did a pilot program at Hill, and now they're stretching it all across the branch.
Absolutely. And I think they are taking those lessons learned and saying, again, the platforms, that's why they have four of them now. And they just went through the configuration control board, which means that they got approval to be used. They meet the security requirements and other standard requirements.
Mm-hmm. A lot more here, including... religious services as a commodity.
This was given to me by a friend in industry, and I tell you, I say this from the really file of federal procurement
with
really?
A question mark at the
really?
End.
Really? So what the Army doing is they are conducting a reverse auction for Catholic priest services. And this is a notice on FedBizOps. We have it linked to it so you can find it yourself. And basically the line items include holy days of obligation, Sunday Mass, Saturday Mass, sacraments, emergency calls, and contract manpower reporting.
Huh.
I'm familiar with all of those other ones except for contract manpower reporting. I'm not exactly sure where that fits in. That may just be an administrative thing. But what's interesting about this is when did these types of services, religious services, become a commodity that you can find, you know, off the shelf? I'll take, you know, Rabbi 1 and Priest 2 and Reverend 3, and they can just come on by.
There's a great joke in there, too, I believe, but I don't think you can tell it on the radio.
Do they walk into a bar? No, I don't know.
That's what I've heard.
So, but anyways. Yeah,
this is service as a service.
Service as a service. What really I thought was interesting was when I do a search for FedBizOps over the last 90 days, and just do a search in quotes, religious services, nine items come up, nine contracting actions.
Wow.
So, and they're anywhere from pre-solicitation to market research to awards, but none of them use reverse auctions. They all were firm fixed price contracts saying, we need some help. Who can help us?
Right.
This is like, okay, I can come do Sunday Mass at, you know, $50 an hour. I can do it at $45 an hour.
Wow.
I can do it at $40 an hour. So it's an odd way. And
that's
why my colleague in industry said, from the really file?
Yes, that is quite interesting. You've got a link to the FedBizOps notice for this, so people can see it for themselves inside the reporter's notebook. And I thank you, as always, for coming on.